From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Coming up, a federal judge says construction can resume on New York's Empire Wind offshore wind project. It's one of the state's largest clean energy projects. It's expected to generate electricity, yes, and also jobs. Patricio Rubio checks in with Climate Jobs New York. And with flu activity surging across the country, so is the flood of misinformation, especially online, about antiviral medications. Dr. Jess Steyer, founder of Unbiased Science, helps us cut through the noise. But we start tonight with news from the town of Fallsburg, New York, because on February 3rd, voters in the Fallsburg Central School District will decide on a $56 million capital project intended to fix long-standing building issues, improve safety, and upgrade heating and cooling systems across district schools. District leaders say the plan would come with no increase to local school taxes thanks to a combination of state aid, capital reserves, and retired debt. For more Radio Catskills, Tim Bruno spoke with Dr. Ivan Katz, superintendent of the Fallsburg Central School District.
The proposed project has been years in the making. We've planned for several years to fix our deteriorating parking lots, but knew it would be expensive to do so. So we set up capital reserves. Capital reserves are monies that are set aside for a specific purpose to be able to be used down the road once the reserves are filled. The capital reserves were approved by the voters of the school district. In terms of the air conditioning and heating, which are the most expensive parts of this project, a New York State law approved by the governor in 2024 set 88 degrees as the maximum temperature for occupancy of all spaces used by students in public school buildings beginning in September 2025. This law prompted us to have to take action to make sure that hot temperatures wouldn't affect school attendance for kids.
There was also a 2023 building condition survey. Beyond what the survey identified, were there issues you were already seeing day to day that made the action feel urgent?
The survey identified a number of smaller items that would need to be addressed in the next few years. In terms of what we were seeing from day to day, we've received complaints about our parking lot conditions for many years, as our parking lots and paved areas have been steadily deteriorating. In terms of air conditioning, this past June, our school buildings were getting so hot, especially our cafeterias and gymnasiums, that we had to close school early on several days. With the end of the year examinations and other school activities, losing necessary school time was not something we wanted to have as an ongoing concern in the years to come.
How often did that happen, the heat disrupting learning in recent years?
It really was a new event that really caught our attention last year with the hot days in June, which caused us to have early dismissals in the last few weeks of June, which the last few weeks in June are when we have important regents examinations and so forth. So in the past, we just dealt with it. But now that we knew it was becoming a law, we knew that we had to take additional steps.
You mentioned the safety concerns about the parking lots, of course, the big ticket item of HVAC. In addition to those items, there are several smaller projects included in this proposal. Which of those do you think will have the most immediate impact on safety or daily operations?
Well, I think they all will have some impact on daily operations. If we look at the parking lot situation right now, the entrance to the elementary school drive has about a 40-foot wide entrance. This makes it challenging in the mornings, afternoons, and whenever we have school events like parent-teacher conferences, and the traffic patterns at those times become very challenging. At times, we have to have the police present to direct traffic, creating additional parking and changing the layout of the entrance by adding an additional lane will help to address some of the congestion that we get.
Okay. And then there's also card swipe access as an upgrade. How does that change school security compared to a traditional key?
Well, great question. Parts wipes for classrooms will make our classrooms safer, as classroom doors will always be in a locked position and will eliminate the issues that happen when staff members lose or misplace their keys.
And also among this, proposal is the big headline here: no increase to local school taxes. How is that possible with a price tag of $56.5 million? I kind of mentioned that at the top, but just walk folks through that.
Yeah, this is the question that I get asked most about, and it's important for our taxpaying school community members to know the answer to this important question. To begin with, we have a project with a price tag of $56.5 million. This is a hefty sum of money any way you look at it. That said, we timed this project to take place after we retired debt that we're currently paying on previous building projects. That retired debt equals $5.2 million. Our timing also included setting up capital reserve funds several years ago in anticipation of this building project. Of the $15 million we saved in those reserves, we'll need to use about $11 million for this project. The biggest part of the finances, though, comes from the state aid that we'll be getting back on this project. That state aid equals about $41 million. When you add the $5.2 million in retired debt, add the $11 million in capital reserve funds, and top that off with the $41 million that we'll be getting back from the state, you have a project equaling about $57 million, or just under.
Some residents might worry about some future tax impacts down the line. Are there any assurances you can give them based on the district's past projects?
Our past projects have also come in at a 0% increase in taxes. We're following a trend we put into place many years ago, and that trend was to put building projects forward that would not require raising additional taxes. Our past performance is the best indicator that I can offer. Mm.
And there's a second proposition on the ballot to purchase a neighboring property that's near the Benjamin Kosar Elementary School. What does that do? What problem does that solve?
So, as I described earlier, we only have about 40 feet of roadway to enter the elementary school. We'd really like to improve safety by widening the entrance and exit to allow for our heavy traffic flows and to also give our buses more room to enter and exit. Additionally, our current entrance makes it very challenging for emergency vehicles to gain entrance at times when we have high traffic at the elementary school.
And you mentioned that one of the big questions that you're hearing most from residents after, holding a public forum and releasing informational videos that's reached a lot of people online, one of the big questions you're getting is, how is it possible that there's no increase to local school taxes? Are you getting other kinds of questions as well?
Well, really, the only two questions that I get are the ones you covered, and that is, how are we able to put a $56.5 million project forward without an additional tax impact, which is the number one question. And then the number two question is about, do we really need to have do we really need to purchase that property? And I think we answered both of those, but those were the only two questions this entire planning season that I really got. Everything else seems to be understood.
If voters approve both of these propositions, what's the timeline and what changes would families notice first?
The timeline for major work to begin would be the summers of 2027 and 2028, perhaps going into the summer of 2029 if there are any issues with getting building materials due to tariffs or any other unplanned for obstacles. The roadways and parking lots would be very visible. Air conditioning and other repairs would not be as visible, as that work would be taking place in the buildings and on rooftops.
And then what, as voters head to the polls on February 3rd, what do you most want them to understand about this proposal?
First of all, I really want our school community to come out and vote and to know that we've been listening to concerns about parking lots and overall improvement of the school district's buildings and grounds. The public's voice matters, and we hope to be making positive changes that the school community will be enjoying for many years to come. I also want them to know that this project will really have no additional impact on their taxes.
And where can folks get more information in the district about the proposal and the information about the voting?
Information is available on the school district website, www.fallsburgcsd.net. And we've also been posting information on the Fallsburg Central School District Facebook account.
That's Dr. Ivan Katz, superintendent of the Fallsburg Central School District. Thank you so much for joining us, Doctor.
A pleasure, and thank you for having me.
This morning on Radio Chatskill, Tim Bruno also checked in with an expert about flu medications because there's a lot of confusion out there right now. As flu activity is surging across the country, so is misinformation about antiviral medications. Viral TikToks blame Tamiflu for frightening side effects, while homeopathic influences are promoting so-called Tamiflu tea. To cut through the noise, we spoke with Dr. Jess Steyer, a public health scientist and founder of Unbiased Science. Dr. Steyer starts off by explaining what antiviral flu medicines actually are and how they differ from flu vaccines.
Vaccine is all about prevention, right? The vaccine trains our immune system to recognize the virus before we're ever exposed. Antivirals are treatment. So that's what we use when we're already sick. And they work by stopping the virus from replicating in our body. And this shortens how long we're sick, reduces the severity. And for high-risk people, it does a really good job of lowering the chance of hospitalization or death. Just a real quick analogy that I love to give is that you think of the vaccine as your seatbelt and antivirals as the airbag.
Okay, that's a good way of thinking of it. What are some of the most common myths you're seeing out there, and why do they persist?
You mentioned a few. So a big one I'm seeing right now is that, you know, you just have to have this tea. They're calling it the flu tea or star anise tea, and basically saying that, oh, this is a replacement for antivirals like Tamiflu and Xofluza. Now, there's a little nugget of truth there where Tamiflu was originally derived from this thing called shikimic acid, which is found in star anise. But ultimately, what Tamiflu and what these antivirals include is very, very, very different from what's in the tea, right? And brewing tea is certainly not the same thing as taking a pharmaceutical with a very precise tested dose. So sure, having tea is great. It could make us feel better, especially if we have a sore throat, but it is not a treatment for the flu. Another big thing is that Tamiflu can cause hallucinations and seizures. This is something I'm seeing a lot about in headlines. And it is true that there have been very rare reports of some neuropsychiatric effects. However, it's very important to note that flu itself causes delirium, especially in young kids with high fevers. So oftentimes people are sort of conflating the drug's effect with the actual flu, which is likely what's causing those outcomes.
Can you explain why starting antivirals within that first 48-hour window of, you know, identifying symptoms matters so much, but it's also still useful afterward?
Yeah, so these drugs, they work, as I mentioned, by blocking viral replication. And early in infection is when the virus is multiplying really, really fast. And so that's the window where we have the opportunity to really slow it down. So after that 48-hour window, the virus has already done a lot of damage. So that benefit shrinks with, you know, every passing day. That said, for people who are hospitalized or who are high risk, it is still clinical guidance to treat beyond 48 hours because some benefit is better than none when the stakes are very high.
And not everybody with the flu necessarily needs an antiviral. So how can folks assess, or what questions should they ask their doctor to know whether it makes sense for them to take one or for a loved one they're caring for?
That's a great, great point. So for otherwise healthy older kids and adults, you might not need one, right? So as with all things, flu antivirals do come with some side effects and some risks. So for those people where risk of hospitalization and death is lower, you want to focus on treating symptoms, right? So rest, certainly increase your fluid uptake, treat fever if you're absolutely miserable, you know, if you have that hit by a truck feeling. And, you know, it might not be necessary to take these antivirals. A common side effect of Tamiflu, for example, is GI upset, nausea, and that might not be worth it if you're lower risk. But again, if you're in those high-risk groups that I mentioned, you know, over 65, young children, antivirals are a very important tool. So you want to call your clinician, find out if you're considered high-risk, and if it's their recommendation that you want to start treatment early.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dr. Jess Steyer, a public health scientist and founder of Unbiased Science, helping us cut through misinformation around flu antivirals as cases continue to rise this winter. We've talked about high-risk groups like young children, older adults, people with underlying conditions. What are some signs listeners should be especially alert to that might warrant urgent care or early treatment?
Yeah, so for kids, you want to look for things like difficulty breathing, if their ribs pull in with each breath that they take. Certainly, if you're seeing bluish lips or, you know, blue face or skin, severe irritability, or if they seem hard to wake up, if they're not drinking fluids, or if they have a fever with a rash, that's when you certainly want to, you know, either go to urgent care, call the emergency room, or at the very least, contact your pediatrician. They almost always have an emergency line, you know, that they could direct you whether emergency care is necessary. For adults, you're looking for things like shortness of breath, persistent chest pain or pressure, confusion, inability to keep fluids down, or symptoms that improve but then come back worse with fever and cough. And, you know, really that last thing is important because it could be a signal of a secondary bacterial infection like pneumonia, and that is absolutely an ER situation.
There's a newer drug that's a single dose versus some older options that might require a multi-day course, I believe. Can you talk about how those choices are maybe between medications like a Tamiflu or some of these newer treatments?
Yeah, so there's actually four FDA-approved antivirals. Two are probably not what you're talking about because these are the ones that are mostly used in hospitals that are administered by IV or inhalation. But the two that most people know of are Tamiflu, and the newer is called Xofluza. And Xofluza people really like because it's one pill, less GI upset. There's some data that it might actually clear that viral shedding faster, meaning you might be less, contagious for less time. However, it is pricier. It could run you about $200 without insurance. And we're seeing that availability is really spotty, especially now. There are also some groups that it's not recommended for, like if you're pregnant or if you're severely immunocompromised. So again, it really just depends on your specific situation. And this is a conversation to have with your healthcare provider.
Given that we're in this big surge, is there anything you wish people knew more about integrating strategies to combat flu during flu season?
Yeah, I think, we have to really lean into the Swiss cheese model of public health, which is what we like to talk about, how, antivirals are an amazing tool in our toolkit, right? But we also have vaccines, and certainly best to prevent illness if you can. And just to note on that, yes, this is a really, really terrible flu season, and the flu vaccine is not the best match for the strains that are currently circulating, but it is still highly effective at keeping us out of the hospital and preventing deaths. So we have the vaccine. We do have these antivirals that could be especially important for high-risk groups. We also have other things like masking. Masking is a highly effective way to prevent respiratory disease transmission. We have things like, increasing ventilation whenever possible, opening windows, which I know could be tricky during these winter months, and testing. It's such an important thing. Most pharmacies carry these combo COVID flu tests now, which are great. And knowing what we have is important because then we know how to treat it if necessary.
Dr. Jess Steyer, public health scientist and founder of Unbiased Science. You can find more evidence-based explainers from her team online at unbiasedscience.com and on social media at Unbiased Science. As always, this conversation isn't a substitute for medical advice. Talk with your healthcare provider about what's right for you and your family. Dr. Jess Steyer, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And thanks again to Tim Bruno, who you can hear every weekday morning at 10 live on Radio Chatskill. Tomorrow on Radio Chatskill, Governor Kathy Hochul's office has not released her full schedule for more than 15 months, which raises questions about how much time she's spending on fundraising versus governing. Tim Bruno speaks with Chris Bragg, Albany Bureau Chief for New York Focus, about the governor, her campaign activities, and transparency. That's Radio Chatskill, local news and conversations, tomorrow morning at 10.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. A federal judge has cleared the way for construction to resume on New York's Empire Wind offshore wind project, one of the state's largest clean energy developments. The project is centered offshore south of Long Island and is expected to generate enough electricity to power about 500,000 homes. It has also already generated thousands of construction jobs. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio spoke about the project with Esther Rosario, Executive Director of Climate Jobs New York.
Let's talk about, at a high level, what does this court decision actually change on the ground right now for Empire Wind and the workers involved?
So it means that we've won yet again. I think that this decision means that workers on Empire Wind can get back to work while litigation continues. And we're still waiting. We also have another project called Sunrise, and they're going to be heard February 2nd. So we do have some workers still in limbo. I do think that as much as this exercise seems fun for the Trump administration, it has caused a lot of worker stress. If you recall, in April, the Trump administration issued a stop work order for this same project, Empire Wind 1. So these workers are now sort of routinely looking over their shoulder and waiting for the next shoe to drop. Again, as you said before, this is billions of dollars of investments and union jobs that these workers fought hard for. This industry didn't just happen. Offshore wind really came to New York because labor made it happen. In the wake of Hurricane Sandy, unions recognized that climate change was a working people's issue and built the political will to launch an entire new industry, obviously with the help of the environmental movement and more. But that foresight is actually delivering real jobs and real benefits for communities on the ground. So we're hopeful that this is the last time we have to fight back against these unfair stop work orders that are coming down and really impacting families' lives. And again, this one came a couple days before Christmas. So it just really shows what really is driving this administration at the federal level is not working people. So we're hopeful that this is the end of it, but we're prepared to fight if it's not.
Let's just remind folks, Empire Wind is a proposed major offshore wind energy project being developed off the coast of Long Island. You know, about the uncertainty, I just want to know if you have any sort of, if you could talk about that sort of uncertainty at that, when this works, stop work period, I'm sure there was a lot of uncertainty. You said it happened around the holidays. And what did that pause mean for those union workers and their families?
That really means, like, you know, you don't know if you're going to get a paycheck or not. It really is that granular. You know, this industry, construction trades in particular, they are gig workers. So they go from project to project. And these huge infrastructure projects are both, they are decades in the making. This isn't, you know, actually, I think the Empire Wind 1 permitting process started under the last Trump administration. So it's decades-long process of making sure we get it right, making sure that the jobs are family-sustaining and they are creating benefits for the local community. So these workers have been waiting for this opportunity for decades. So it really, again, impacts people's mental health, their well-being, and their pockets.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned the South Brooklyn Marine Terminal, which has been mentioned as sort of a cornerstone of this project. Why is that site so important? You know, not just for Empire Wind, but for like the future of offshore wind in New York.
New York is seen as the leader here. And if we can, again, get these projects going, we still will be leading in offshore wind. And that really means building out the infrastructure necessary to not only build these projects, but also to be a hub, be a hub for manufacturing and making sure those are also producing domestic union jobs, which we really haven't had in the country in quite some time. So it's, you know, again, a little bit disheartening because I actually think if the semantics are a bit different, that actually the federal government is preaching the same things that we're trying to create. We want these jobs. We want to build an infrastructure that allows for growth. It seems like Canada now is picking up where the United States is backing off offshore wind. We border Canada. There could be a lot of opportunities to grow this industry and make sure that New Yorkers are benefiting from the jobs that we could create.
Let's talk about some of the critics, like you mentioned. Some critics argue that offshore wind projects are risky or disruptive. How do you respond to those concerns about the cost and reliability or the potential environmental impact a project like this could have?
At this time, I really hate to bring up Denmark, but I'm going to bring up Denmark. They're paying people for their energy. Because they have figured it out and diversified their grid and completely become energy independent, which, again, if we're talking about semantics, energy dominance, energy independence is the same thing. And it will help us meet our climate goals, but also allows us to keep prices stable. Eventually, we could be doing the same thing. Imagine not having a bill. Mm. Imagine getting money back from the energy that we're producing. And because Denmark saw this as an opportunity back in, I believe it was World War I, they have decades and decades been transitioning their grid to allow for this. So again, as much as there is some hesitation and people are feeling like this is all new, like this is not new. It's been around for a very long time. And in fact, if you go back to the windmills of before, like wind has been around quite some time. So I do feel like it's an easy talking point and it's very uninformed.
Now, let's turn into the state budget. Recently, Governor Kathy Hochul gave a presentation of the 2027 state budget. Have you heard anything in this year's budget discussions or appropriations that you see as a positive for Empire Wind, offshore, or clean energy and planning?
You know, she definitely did tout offshore wind in her speech. I do think that because these projects are ongoing, it's just a matter of, again, putting one foot in front of the other. Recently, she did, through NYSERDA, release some funding for port infrastructure necessary for offshore wind, which, again, I think signals in many ways that she's not backing down from offshore wind being a major energy source in New York State, and that she understands that we need to keep building the infrastructure necessary to sustain this in industry.
Now, looking ahead, what should New Yorkers be watching for as construction restarts and this project, you know, moves toward completion?
Honestly, given we are headed towards we're in a gubernatorial election year, I would be watching how your elected officials move during this time. You know, it for me, it feels very black and white. You stand up for union jobs or you don't. This isn't a far-reaching new industry that we just created. This is an industry that exists all over the world. So I would stay educated, do your reading, do your homework, and make sure that if there's misinformation that's being spread, that you really check your sources and see who's behind that.
We were talking to Esther Rosario, executive director of Climate Jobs New York, speaking with us about the federal court ruling allowing construction to resume on the Empire Wind offshore wind project and what it could mean for jobs, grid reliability, and New York's clean energy future. So Esther, thank you so much for talking to us. I do really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you so much, Patricio Rubio, for that report. Thank you, listener, for being here with me tonight. I'm Jason Dole, and that's it for me. That's the end of the Local Edition, although I will be back again tomorrow night at 6 for more Local Edition. Coming up at 7 tonight, we got 2 hours of the Retro Cocktail Hour, but before that, more news is on the way from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Canoza Hall, featuring 33 guest rooms and bungalows, a three-meal period restaurant by Foster Supply Hospitality's culinary team, and a full-service Hemlock Spa. CanozaHall.com. From The Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. Information and schedule at CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.